First, giving honor to God, to Sporkins for that wonderful introduction, to the spiritual leaders of this city on a hill, to each of you who is gathered here this evening to celebrate the life and work of Martin Luther King Jr., and especially to these singing aggregations that have forced me to open the floodgates of my own memory and travel back across the years to hear again these tools of the Spirit that enabled us to cut a path through the wilderness of our despair. I thank the gospel choir here for reminding us of that which gave us hope over the past 50 years of my own life, whereas pastor of New Bethel Baptist Church and a member of the Congress of the United States, I engaged in these weapons of mass instruction that gave us the strength to keep on keeping on. I want to thank the Glee Club for not only remembering the Song of Africa that was and is a tool of the Spirit by which we continue to cut a path through the wilderness of man's inhumanity to man on the continent and around the world, but also reminding us of that tool of the Spirit that called to memory the Joshua generation. And it's so appropriate that we should gather in this chapel on a hill, some 188 years old, that has been placed appropriately at the pinnacle of academic excellence at Amherst. I thank you for the opportunity to celebrate with you one of the most significant observances of the life and work of Martin Luther King Jr. and Black history since 1964 for me. 1964 was the year when, after the decade of the 50s and 60s, a generation that called itself the New Frontier changed America. As I stood in the East Room of the White House on July 2nd, 1964, and watched Lyndon Johnson sign a piece of paper as Martin King and I observed him, that made a dream of millions, hundreds of millions of people who had been taken from Africa, that one day this nation would rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men, black men and white men and red men and brown men and yellow men and women, are created equal. That was a golden moment for me. And I'm pleased here today to be here as you reflect upon an issue that is front page in the world today and in American newspapers. After the president announced the structure of his faith-based initiative, an initiative that defines the role of religion and politics in the affairs of men. And so I've come on this, the first Martin Luther King Jr. observance since we fashioned the bill that became an act 17 years after his assassination. And I'm pleased to address a subject that projects the serious role of religious leaders and political leaders in the affairs of men. I speak with some authority on this subject because, as you have been told, I have been a pastor in the last 50 years, the first 10 years of which were as Martin Luther King's personal representative to the leadership of the U.S. House and Senate and to the presidents of the United States in the decade of the 60s. The next two generations spent as a member of the Congress of the United States, one of only about 10,000 citizens of this nation who've had that privilege of serving in the history of our country. And then the third decade, that of trying to demonstrate what is my thesis today, and that is that religion and politics are interrelated, interdependent, and of equal importance. Against the background of being a minister politician who's been at the core of every major change in public policy affecting people of African descent in the last 50 years, I say that to you without fear of successful contradiction. Religion and politics are interrelated, interdependent, and of equal importance. Now, I say that because I've had the experience of working with the singularly most important man with the most important message for the most violent century in the history of mankind. His name was Martin Luther King Jr., and his message was simply this: either we learn to live together as brothers and sisters on this planet, or we will perish together as fools. And never in the history of mankind has that message been more relevant than today. And I say that because of that, I know that Martin Luther King Jr., like the founding fathers, and like President Barack Obama, were both spiritual and political geniuses. They were political and spiritual geniuses because they understood one fundamental thing, and that is that all human beings of every race, every creed, every color require five things to have a decent quality of life. All human beings of every tribe, every race, every creed and color require access to income. You've got to have something coming in. Got to have income. That's why we were taught in the Christian church to pray, give us this day our daily bread. We've got to have income. Secondly, you must have education to earn income. Children do not come here knowing how to earn income. Have to be taught. Third, you must have health care to live long enough to enjoy it. What good is it to have some income and some education, and you're dying of cancer or diabetes or high blood pressure or AIDS? You've got to have access to health care. Fourth, you must have access to housing or shelter from the elements. Cavemen understood that. Man cannot live out in the elements. And so he found something called a cave. Because the hurricanes came and blizzards came, they knew to get up in the cave and call it home. Got to have income, education, health care, housing, and justice. So that if you have some income, education, health care, and housing, nobody can take it from you with impunity. Those five things, income, education, health care, housing, and justice, is what Jesus called the abundant life. Brothers and sisters, let me tell you, if you've got access to adequate income, education, to make money, health care, to live long enough to enjoy it, housing, and justice, you're living on a mountain underneath a cloudless sky. You have access to those five things. They understood that. And having understood that, they became the founding fathers, Martin Luther King Jr. and Barack Obama, spiritual and political geniuses. Because religion and politics are interrelated, interdependent, and of equal importance. You all follow me now. As spiritual geniuses, they understood that, like the prophet Isaiah, they are anointed of God to declare good news to the least of these, those who have least income, education, health care, housing, and justice. And they got that from the prophet Isaiah. If I were to give a text for my message this evening, would be the 61st chapter, where it says, the Spirit of the Lord God, the spiritual, is upon me, because he hath anointed me to declare good news to the poor, to bind up the brokenhearted, and to set at liberty them that are bound. In short, the founding fathers and Barack Obama and Martin Luther King Jr. were members of what we call the Abraham Federation. You ought to know that all Muslims, all Christians, all Jews maintain that Abraham was the father of the faith and that Moses was the lawgiver. And he didn't give 10 suggestions. He gave 10 commandments. Thou shalt not kill. Thou shalt not steal. Thou shalt not covet other people's oil. Thou shalt not covet. Thou shalt not commit adultery. Y'all stay right in here. Thou shalt not bear false witness. Not suggestions, commandments, because there are consequences to lying and cheating and stealing and killing and committing adultery. Not suggestions, but commandments. And they all are taught that if my people, who call by my name, will humble themselves and pray and turn from their wicked ways, I will forgive their sins and I will heal the land. Marvelous. It takes a spiritual genius to understand that. And it takes a spiritual genius to know that you ought to love your neighbor in self-defense. I want you to hang that out on the clothesline of your mind and let the Holy Spirit grow over it. You ought to love your neighbor in self-defense. I want my neighbor to have his own income. Because if he doesn't, Guess whose income he's coming for? Huh? I want my neighbor to have an appreciation for education, because if he doesn't, guess whose schools he ruined? My child's schools. And if my child doesn't learn to earn some income, I'll lose my 501c. I lose my Social Security when I can't earn income, and I'm sick and I don't have the ability to achieve it. I want some child that I loved into wholeness to remember me. I want my neighbor to have health care. Why? Because if he doesn't, guess who's going to get TB? That's my neighbor. We breathe the same air. I want my neighbor to have his own house. Particularly when it gets as cold as it is tonight. Because if he doesn't have his own house, guess whose house he'll break into? My house. And I want my neighbor to have justice. Because if he doesn't, guess who's going to feel the weight of his anger and hostility at the pain of being unjustly treated? And anger leads to violence. And violence drives people insane. You got to be stone crazy. You don't mind that expression. To tie a bomb to yourself and say, I'm going to fix this thing now. I'm going to blow myself up. This magnificent body that God has given each and every one of us. To get rid of people who are around me. And because the world is in danger of becoming an insane asylum, with the inmates in charge, because they have been denied access to five things: income, education, health care, housing, and justice. This observance of Martin Luther King's life and work is the most important for the rest of our lives. And so I'm happy to be here at a time when we take an instructive example from spiritual geniuses. But these men were also, and are, in Barack Obama, political geniuses. Because the founding fathers started it, but they explained to us that politics is a process of determining who gets how much of what, when, and where in five areas. I can tell you on basis of profound experience as the Reverend Congressman Fauntroy, chairman of the Subcommittee on Domestic Monetary Policy for 6 years, and chairman of the Subcommittee on International Development, Finance, Trade, and Monetary Policy, a preacher in charge of that, and he requires his colleagues to refer to him as the Reverend Congressman Chairman. That's because I knew what the founding fathers understood. That it is a role of government to facilitate access to five things if we're going to have any domestic tranquility. Let me explain that. They were geniuses. In the preamble to the Constitution, they said, we the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, to establish justice, to provide for the general welfare. What's the general welfare? I'm glad you asked that question. The general welfare is when everybody has access to enough income, education, health care, housing, and justice not to bother anybody else. In other words, you can't have domestic tranquility if you don't have general welfare. That's the genius of that which about which Martin spoke in that speech of the 20th century. He said, I have a dream. A dream deeply rooted in the American dream. What is the American dream? I'm glad you asked that question. The American dream is that there ought to be a place somewhere on the planet where people of every race and every creed and every color can enter a social contract to care for, protect, and defend one another beyond race, beyond creed, beyond color. And that's the dream. And that's the dream that caused someone from Kenya to call me at about 10:45 on the evening of November the 4th, 2008. They said, Reverend Congressman, we are so happy in Kenya. We're so excited the president has declared a national holiday. And America will again be special. Oh, special? Yes, yes, special. I was with Martin Luther King Jr. in 1962. When Africa was becoming decolonized, we was told. And all of them, as they formed nation after nation, were quoting our Declaration of Independence. We hold these truths to be self-evident. And we're quoting our preamble, we the people, in order to establish justice, where none will prey upon the weakness of others. In order to form a more perfect union, to provide for the general welfare. Oh, that's why around the world people said it's special tonight. I saw them jumping up and down in Japan. In Japan, yes. I saw them, I heard them from Sudan and from the Congo. I heard them from the Middle East on both sides. Saying, oh yes, I have known many rivers. As I told you, I was chair of the Subcommittee on International Development, Finance, Trade, and Monetary Policy. So in overseeing the multilateral development institutions, the World Bank and the IMF and the African Development Bank and the Asian Development Bank, the Inter-American Development Bank, I've known many rivers. I've known rivers in Africa. From the Nile. I've known rivers in Southeast Asia and in Latin America and in Kosovo and in Europe. I've known rivers. And what happened on that night when America became special again was that people started singing with Sam Cooke. I was born by the river in a little tent. Just like the river, I've been running ever since. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change is going to come. Oh, yes, it will. Huh? It's been too hard living, but I'm afraid to die because I don't know what's up there beyond the sky. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change is going to come. And do you know that 80% of the people on this planet have been praying for a year that the American people would have sense enough to elect Barack Obama president? 80%, I know it, as a result of a scientifically reliable and objectively verifiable poll that was taken by the prestigious Reader's Digest magazine. That polled people on every continent and in every country across the world, and they said 80% give us Barack Obama because we're tired of leadership that does not understand that it is a role of government to facilitate access to five things. And those five things that people are caught up in what Isaiah said, you must be anointed to declare good news to the least of these. Good news to those who have least income, education, healthcare, housing, if you want to have some domestic tranquility. You love your neighbor in self-defense. And that is evidence that you love God. That God loves all of his children. And God wants all of his children to have the abundant life. And so moved by that history and that practice, I must tell you that my colleagues in the Congress for 20 years asked me, Reverend, why do you want to be on the banking committee? You know about the good book, but you don't know about domestic monetary policy and the Federal Reserve. And I told them that I wanted to be on the banking committee because in my effort to declare good news to the poor, I have learned that cash rules in all matters. You got to have some income if you want to have education. How many of y'all witness to that? You got to have money to get educated. These people that I spend 10, 15 years learning how to teach you to work for nothing. Pay for it. Cost money to get an education. It costs money to get health care. I dare you to get sick and go to the hospital. Say, doctor, I'm dying. You know what he'll ask you? Do you have a card? Because if you don't have a card, die. Cost cash money to get health care. It takes money to buy a house. Don't go to the inner city of any nation, any city in our nation, and expect you're going to buy a house nowadays without big cash money. They are moving blacks out of Washington to Soweto. I meant to say to Prince George's County. They're moving them out of Harlem to Far Rockaway because cities are beautiful for situation. And when you got to spend 3 hours driving in to make the money, why not move them out and live there and jog to work? I don't want you to think I'm clear, but I was on the Banking, Finance, and Urban Affairs Committee for 20 years, and I'm clear that we must look out for the least of these if there's to be any domestic tranquility. And so I don't want you all to think that because I, as a minister, say cash rules and all matters, but every time a group of elected officials sits down to make a decision in our democracy, they're deciding five things. Who's going to get the money out of this? Whose children are going to get education? Who's going to get health care? Who's going to get housing? Who's going to get justice? So whenever I came into a meeting, they would say, here come the damn preacher. Because he's related religion to politics. He's asked the question. Now, gentlemen, and I thank God there were ladies who joined it. In fact, I must admit that as a pastor for 50 years, if I had a choice between men and women, give me the women. Because they are spiritually tuned because of the conditioning of the inferiority reference that's attached in a sinful world to being a woman. And so when they would see me coming, I said, the Reverend Chairman is in the room. And the chairman's mark on this measure is going to be, who's going to get the money? Who's going to get the children, the education, the health care, and the housing, and the justice? Because I have to look out for the least of these in self-defense. I want you to know about 3 years ago, as we got deeper and deeper into this recession that is about to be a serious depression, I was leaving the church at about 2 a.m. And any pastor in the country who's serious knows that a pastor has no day to rest because the least of these are always pulling. I was leaving the church and walking to the bus stop, and three young men walked up to me and said, hands up. Now, I was the karate king of Capitol Hill. I mean, I love the Lord, but just in case. Don't mess with me. I can break a neck with my hand and a back with my foot. But I can't karate chop a 9mm weapon or a bullet. So I said, threw my hands up. And one of the young men said, "Oh, Reverend, we're sorry." I said, "What?" I said, "Boy, I'm going to tell your grandmama on you." Because his mama was in jail and his father was killed in a drug ring. He said, "We're sorry, Reverend." I said, "Why don't y'all go into Ward 3, where the rich people live?" They say, "It's too dangerous over there." So they got police on every corner. They don't mind what we do to y'all here. So if you can't rob the one you want, rob the one you're near. That's why I live in self-defense. And I tell my colleagues, "Listen, y'all don't live where I live. If y'all don't get some money to get some education, to health care, housing, and justice, my life is at stake." I was telling yesterday that I learned a song in the Sunday school. It was, "It Pays to Serve Jesus." It's saying, "It pays to serve Jesus. It pays every day. It pays every step of the way. And though the pathway to glory may sometimes be drear, you have Jesus each step of the way." And when they looked at me and said, "Oh, Reverend, we're sorry," I said, "It pays. It pays to serve Jesus." But they knew, if they knew anything about me, I was serious about trying to get them and their families some income, education, health care, housing, and justice. It pays to honor the prophet Isaiah. You may not always win, but you never lose. I've dreamed many dreams that never came true, that vanished away with the dawn, but I've realized enough of my cherished dreams to make me want to dream on. I've trusted many a friend who failed me and left me to weep alone. But I found enough of my friends, Muslims and Christians and Jews, true blue, to make me want to trust on. I've sown many seeds that fell by the way for the birds to feed upon. But I've held enough golden sheaves in my hand to make me want to sew on. I held it on July 2nd, 1964. I held it on August the 6th, 1965, with the Voting Rights Act. I held it on August the 20th with the sanctions bill against South Africa. Enough golden sheaves in my hand to make me want to sew on. I've drained the cup of disappointment and pain and walked many miles without song. But I've sipped enough nectar from the roses of life. November 4th, 2008. Sipped enough nectar from the roses of life to make me want to live on and to say to this generation, this Joshua generation, what Barack said to Joe Lowry and me 2 years ago. He said, "You all were the Moses generation. We are the Joshua generation. And we've said to the 10 spies," don't get me preaching now. Told the 10 spies who said, "Look, we can't enter Canaan. The giants over there, and we are like grasshoppers in their sight and in our own sight. But Joshua and Caleb," Joshua fit the battle. Joshua and Caleb said, "Oh, yes, we can. Yes, we can." And when I heard it 2 years ago, I was about to shout for joy, because I knew that without weapons being fired and without bombs being placed in cars, that if God wills it and God's people of every race and creed and color get serious about it, there will be joy on the evening of November 4th, 2008. when it was clear that we had developed a generation for which I had been looking for 40 years. 40 years. I brought Martin Luther King Jr. to Washington on March the 31st, 1968, to speak at the National Cathedral, which was to be the last sermon he would preach from a pulpit on a Sabbath day. He was depressed because there were those who were rejecting the wisdom of the sages of the ages, about whom we read in the Torah and in the Bible and in the Quran. And he said, look, if everybody turns violent, I will not. If you haven't found something that you're willing to die for, you're not fit to live. He left here and went to Memphis. And in a magnificent speech that will be remembered for the ages, he said, I'm not fearing any man. Been to the mountaintop, seen the promised land. We'll not get there with you, but we as a people, black and white and red and brown and yellow together, will get to the promised land. And I watched young people, the generation that I'd hoped would develop, that would do on their watch what we did on ours. And they started saying, well, if Tiger Woods is the best golfer, we need him on our team. And if Michael Jordan can put it through the hoop, put him on North Carolina's team. And if you keep letting him play, let the NBA be nothing but Africans. Because we need the best for a world that is becoming an insane asylum with the inmates in charge. But if my people call by my name will humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, I'll hear from heaven. And, child, things are going to get easier. And that's what these songs that you've sung were to us in the decades of the 60s and 70s. And they will be your tools of mass instruction that you nurture on the hill of religious life and then live it in the marketplace of the Congress of the United States. We've got a great job to do because we've got to do it by organizing the 80% of the people on this planet who are singing, this is the moment I've waited for. I can hear children singing in Gaza and in Israel. I can hear children singing in the Eastern Congo. I can hear children singing in the Sudan. I can hear children singing in North and South Korea. I can hear children singing all over the world if my people will call by my name. We'll stop talking that talk about religion, but walk the walk. And I want to close with words from Whitney Houston. And there are words that are made meaningful to me because I've had some great moments in time. As I told you, I stood in the East Room of the White House and watched Lyndon Johnson sign that piece of paper bought with the blood of Cheney and Schwerner and Goodman, bought with the blood of Jimmie Lee Jackson, bought with the blood of those four little children who were killed in Sunday school. That was a great moment for me. The next year, I stood in that same White House and watched Lyndon sign another piece of paper that said, let them vote and participate in the process by which we determine who gets how much of what, when, and where. I stood on the floor of the House when, having applied Martin Luther King's genius as shaped by the Founding Fathers, who told us there are two means that I will give you to influence public policy. First, go to the polls and vote for people who, when elected, would translate what you believe into public policy and practice. But they said there might come a time when the legitimate concerns of any citizen might not be addressed by that process, that majority rule process. So we shall say that in the First Amendment, no state shall deny any citizen the right of peaceful assembly to petition the government for redress of grievances. That's why after the success of Birmingham and Selma, I peaceably assembled myself on Thanksgiving Eve in 1984, at a time when ABC and NBC and CBS and CNN had nothing much to report but turkeys, at the South African Embassy, in a meeting that I had requested with the distinguished ambassador, Ambassador Foray, from South Africa, who didn't want to be bothered because he was about to celebrate his best Thanksgiving in America, because Ronald Reagan had won by a landslide, and he had maintained that Bolter ain't heavy. He's our brother. Let them do what they have to do. We should be meddling in their business. Let's have constructive engagement there. And after spending 2 hours in his office, him explaining why the blacks of South Africa loved apartheid. They loved to be separate and poor and without access to income and education and health. They loved it. And after a while, I said, Mr. Ambassador, you have not been persuasive. And unless you call Mr. Bolter and he tells you he's going to dismantle apartheid forthwith, that's college education stuff, forthwith, we're going to sit in this office. And had he been a smart ambassador, he said, Mr. Fauntleroy, it's Thanksgiving Eve. My wife is home fixing the turkey. I can smell it in the oven right now. I'm going home. Now, this carpeting makes good sleeping. There's a toilet out there. Here's the key to it. And there's a water fountain out there. I'll see you Tuesday. But he wasn't smart. He said, what? I'll have you arrested. I said, do it at about 4:30. Because on a slow day, I've alerted Tom Brokaw and Peter Jennings and Dan Rather and Bernard Shaw at CNN that if they had a camera up on Massachusetts Avenue, they might see something. You know what that rascal did? Put me in handcuffs and send me smack out to the cameras. And that evening, on a slow night, all over the country, I was walking into living rooms, and they said, Congressman arrested! And everybody said, who was it, Al? We knew he wasn't any good. And they said, then they saw me, they said, oh, well. You know, they're always getting arrested. But because it was a slow day, the next day, all day, every half hour and a half hour walking in. And people started, what is apartheid about? I can't look at the football game without, and Ted Koppel said, all right, I'll tell you what it's all about. ABC will send a crew to South Africa to film it. And when ABC went, then NBC had to go. And CNN had to go. And CBS had to go. And I sat back for a year, watched them do my work. Raising consciousness and pricking the conscience of enough people that we stood on the floor of the House and overrode the veto of the president. And a prisoner became president. Don't tell me. If my people will be technically competent and spiritually mature, there's nothing that can prevent us from having peace on earth in every region of this world. And so I've had some great moments. I need one more moment in time. One more. I want to see this generation move this nation and the world higher toward the high grounds of principles that we enunciate in our religious teachings but have failed to live. Because religion and politics are interrelated, interdependent, and of equal importance. And spiritual leaders are not to be taillights. We're to be headlights. We're not to be thermometers measuring the temperature, but thermostats setting it. And so when you go forth from this place into your time and your generation of Joshua leaders, I want you to go forth as I go forth, singing with Whitney Houston. Each day I live, I want to be a day to give the best of me. I'm only one, but not alone. My finest day is yet unknown. I broke my heart for every gain. To taste the sweet, I faced the pain. Doing my work. I face the pain. I rise and fall, but through it all, this much remains. I want one more moment in time, when we're more than they thought we could be, when all of our dreams are a heartbeat away and the answers are all up to me. You give me one more moment in time, when we're racing with destiny. Then in that one moment of time, we shall feel eternity. I long to give my very best. I want it all, no time for less. We've laid our plans. Now there's a chance here in our hands. Will you give me one more moment in time? When we're more black and white and red and brown and yellow together, Protestant, Catholic, Jew, Gentile, when we're more than they thought we could be, when all of our dreams are a heartbeat away and the answers are all up, not to Barack and not to the members, all up to me among that 80% around the world. Give me one moment in time, when we're racing with destiny. Then in that one moment of time, we shall be free. Religion and politics.